Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you. And today we have, I think, what will be one of the most extraordinary programs in the four-year history of Media Matters, a show that I'm looking forward to, and I think you will, too. We will have joining us on the phone Gore Vidal, the noted author, political critic, speaking with us today about the 2004 election, about American politics, and about the combination of empire and republic today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Controversy over the leadership at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and its crusade to make PBS and NPR look and sound more like Fox News is heating up on Capitol Hill. Democrats and the House of Representatives have formed a Future of Media Caucus, which sponsored an informal hearing on issues of media bias on May 24th. Event sponsor Congressman John Conyers, a Democrat from Michigan, released a study from the Congressional Research Service, which analyzed transcripts from several cable news programs and found that stories like Michael Jackson's court case received more substantive coverage than stories about voting irregularities in Ohio during the 2004 election, or the lack of evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. David Brock, a former member of the conservative media machine who now runs the website Media Matters for America, which documents and debunks right-wing media misinformation, says it is not uncommon for presidents and their administrations to attempt to manipulate media coverage in a way most favorable to themselves.
The conservative goal appears to be for us to reach a point where there are blue state facts and red state facts, where there is simply no objective truth at all.
With regard to public broadcasting itself, two Democratic congressmen have written to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Inspector General's office, asking it to investigate CPB Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson and his top staffers for actively working to tilt public radio and TV rightward. Representative David Obie of Wisconsin says he signed the letter not because of the specific partisanship of the current controversy, but because partisanship in any form is inappropriate at the CPB.
No one's talking about conservative or liberal. What I want is to see that the law is adhered to, and the law says that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is supposed to keep its cotton-picking nose out of programming and out of politics.
For his part, Tomlinson continues his mission to deliberalize public broadcasting, even though his own surveys show that claim to be groundless. Nevertheless, he's quietly moving ahead with a proposal to critique National Public Radio for perceived pro-Arab bias in its Middle East coverage, another unproven claim. Tomlinson also chairs the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees foreign propaganda projects like the Voice of America and various broadcast outlets in Iraq and the Middle East, and he's recruiting staff from there to work at CPB. At least one PBS TV station manager is circulating a letter among colleagues demanding that Tomlinson and his cabal be sacked for embarking on a, quote, sad, ridiculous witch hunt at a time when we should be standing together to make sure that public broadcasting is funded adequately.
Bill Moyer's broadside against the conservative attack on public broadcasting at the National Conference for Media Reform has whipped right-wing echo chambers on cable TV and talk radio into a frenzy. The following is a short selection of what Moyers said and how conservative pundits have reacted. When Moyers chastised journalists for failing to speak truth to power,
we're seeing unfold a contemporary example of the age-old ambition of power and ideology to punish the journalists who tell the stories that make princes and priests uncomfortable.
Rush Limbaugh responded with this rejoinder, I'd be embarrassed if I were Bill Moyers. I'd close my mouth. The things coming out of his mouth today are literally insane. When Moyers called the contemporary construction of objectivity into question,
those rules divide the world and allow journalists to pretend they have done their job if instead of reporting the truth behind the news, they merely give each side an opportunity to spin the news.
Conservative Communications Center and Parents Television Council founder Brent Bozell called it a Castro-length address at an anti-capitalist confab, screaming with one mind and one bleeding heart. And when Moyers related his long experience in the public broadcasting world to the point of being present at its conception,
as a young policy assistant to President Johnson, I attended in 1964 my first meeting to discuss the future of public broadcasting. I know firsthand that the Public Broadcasting Act was meant to provide an alternative to commercial television and to reflect the diversity of the American people.
Ann Coulter tarred him a paranoid megalomaniac and described his comments as reading fan letters to himself aloud and talking about how he was being persecuted by Republicans. Note that none of the criticisms of Moyers cites a single fact to back up their attacks.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Today, our guest joining us on the phone from California, I believe, is Gore Vidal, the prolific American novelist, playwright, and essayist, and one of the great stylists of contemporary American prose, and also one of the most insightful and provocative commentators on politics and society of the past 50 years in the United States. It is a tremendous honor for me to welcome you, Gore Vidal, to Media Matters.
Well, it's nice to be back in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois.
Have you ever been here?
Yes, I was there. I was acting in a movie called With Honors, and the movie was using the university there as Harvard, because the buildings look not unlike. So I'm a Harvard professor standing out on front at a graduation in your very own university.
What year was this approximately?
Well, With Honors, starring Brendan Fraser and Joe Pesci, was 7 or 8 years ago.
Oh, I remember that movie. Sure. That was actually based on a true story.
Yes.
And Amy Goodman, who's been a guest on the show, apparently was at Harvard when this all took place, and she knew the gentleman that the Pesci character was based upon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Isn't this a small world?
Smaller and smaller.
That's for sure. As a way of introduction for some of our younger listeners who might not be familiar with Gore Vidal's work, back in the 1960s on American television, when talk programs like Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin, the predecessor to the Jerry Springer and Oprah Winfrey shows we know today, peopled the airwaves in the afternoon, they peppered them, and there were these talk shows where guests would come on. In this stage in the 1960s, you were not an uncommon guest on talk television and became somewhat of a prominent figure in a way I don't think would be possible for an intellectual in the United States today. But as a young man, as a boy of 13 or 14, I recall seeing you, and it was either on the Merv Griffin show or the Mike Douglas show one afternoon. You were on discussing, and you were talking about, it was either Myra Breckinridge or Washington, D.C., it was whichever book had just come out. And you were discussing the United States, and you called the United States an empire. And I recall that because I was a young middle-class kid from Cleveland, and I'd never heard the United States called an empire, and you compared the United States to Rome. And this is probably 1966 or 1967. And it stuck with me. And it penetrated my mind. And it made me really think critically about the United States in a way I'd never thought about it before. And I raise this because I think it shows the influence that a media system can have on educating people, enlightening them, opening their minds critically. And it also points to the fact that our current media system, sadly enough, rarely does that.
Well, that is quite true. And I think I was perhaps the first to notice the resemblance, not very close one, but between our American Empire and that of the Roman Empire. But Rome lasted about 600-700 years, and I sometimes wonder, with the news coming out of the Middle East, if we have 600-700 more days, we're not doing terribly well at it. I remember being taken to task by Time magazine, who said, proving what a dreadful person I was. He's the sort of person who says that we have an empire. And my only response was, well, at the end of World War II, which the right wing in the United States was won by the communists, everything was communist, I said, yeah, and what did Stalin get? Well, he got Albania, he got parts of Czechoslovakia, but we got Germany. And in Asia, what did the communists get? Well, they had a bit of Indochina. we got Japan. Now, that's what I call an empire. And we still have them, or had them, until 1989, when the Soviet Union decided to give up, a nasty trick on their part, leaving us absolutely alone, holding the bag.
In your work, I mean, one of the things that I appreciate about it so much in your historical work and in your essays is talking about the relationship of empire to this country, going back historically, really to the beginning of the Republic, and the tension between the two, which is now clearly coming to a head. I mean, how much did the people of this country embrace becoming a global power in the first generations of the Republic?
They didn't think about it in the first generation of the Republic. Also, the Republic was founded by people like Madison, particularly. He wrote most of the Constitution, Jefferson. They were all students of French and Scottish, members of the Enlightenment, as they called it, who had a whole new concept of a world of reason, a world of tolerance, of sensibilities. And they realized, Montesquieu in particular, a French philosopher that very, very much influenced our Constitution, Montesquieu said you cannot maintain, ever in history, a republic and an empire. They cancel each other out. If you keep the empire, the republic will go, as we notice now. If you can get rid of the empire, the republic probably can flourish, which I'd like to see happen since I'm on the side of the republic and not on the side of the empire. But that is the crisis before us, and the politicians, who seem to know no history at all and can't really follow much of anything from day to day, this is why I refer to our leaders as, you know, as the United States of Amnesia. Everything is forgotten, and we make the same mistakes over and over and over again. We're not well-suited for empire, unlike the British. Yes, we're so well-suited they lost North America. Had they been better suited, we might still be involved with England, but luckily we're not. So at the beginning, yes, we had expansionists, of which Jefferson is number one with the Louisiana Purchase, which tripled the size of the United States and added 13, I think it was, more than that, new states to what had been a rather small group of former colonies, which had made a rather small republic. Suddenly, we were huge. We were most of North America. And then we began to look across the Pacific. And then Theodore Roosevelt and friends picked a war with Spain, and we picked it. We got their colonial empire away from them, which gave us Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Caribbean. But best of all, it gave us the Philippines. Now, what we are doing formally, just cutting down trees in Oregon, suddenly we are at the Great Wall of China. There's actually some newsreel footage that I got hold of, and a piece I did on the empire, our empire, showing American Marines in the 1920s in Shanghai and on the Great Wall of China. People were shocked when we showed this on the History Channel. What, you mean to say we invaded China? And I said, yes, yes, indeed we did. It didn't last, but we've been on the march ever since. It has done the Republic no good, which is one of the occasions I'm chatting with you today over what went wrong in Ohio in the late election. And a great deal did go wrong, and all of it ominous. Or as Daryl Zanuck, the movie mogul, used to say in conferences, ominous, very ominous music is heard at this point. Well, it's pretty ominous what is happening to the Republic, where elections are now systemically stolen. And we have Congressman John Conyers of Michigan, a very useful politician, who went out there as a member of the Judiciary Committee, a minority Democrat, and they spent some time examining the voting in Ohio. It this is the biggest story politically in the country in a long, long time. Where's the New York Times? Invisible. Where are the networks and the cable? Barely mention it. We know something went wrong. A few machines didn't work, all that sort of thing. But here he's made a record. He went out there with, I think, a dozen congressmen and their staffers, and they went all over the state of Ohio from county to county, from polling place to polling place, examining the machines, like particularly the electronic ones, which are easily fixed and easily hacked. And it's an astonishing story. And it's, they've now published it as a little book called What Went Wrong in Ohio. And the subtitle is The Conyers Report on the 2004 Presidential Election, with a little introduction by me, hoping to get people to sit down and study it, because the empire is not going to last very much longer. We're too unpopular. Most of the world hates us now after what we've been doing in the Middle East. So we'd better have a very strong republic here at home in order just to remain alive, to be part of the civilized world. And that is kind of a crisis facing us. And it takes 4 years, I think, to corrupt one of these elections. After the events of 2000, into which one member of the Supreme Court apologized for what the Supreme Court had done in awarding the presidency to the loser of the popular vote and perhaps the Electoral College vote. But somebody asked me, do you think Bush will be reelected? I said, well, you must put that properly. Will he be elected?
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been so far. He was selected. I said, well, I think that he'll lose the election of 2004 because he's not popular. It's, even then, his numbers were falling, the percentages. But that doesn't mean that he may not be asked to serve a second term, because they have 4 years in which to fix this election from 2000 to 2004. And the reason I am playing Paul Revere here is that between, they've now got 4 more years between 2004 and 2008 to give us 3 elections in a row in which the loser gets to be president and the winner just goes off and grumbles. So there we are.
We're talking to Gore Vidal today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. We pre-recorded this show a week and a half before going on air, so please do not try to call in today. To sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. We're talking about right now the book What Went Wrong in Ohio, The Conyers Report on the 2004 Presidential Election, which Gore Vidal wrote the introduction to. It was edited by Anita Miller and published up in Chicago, in our home state of Illinois, by the Academy Chicago Publishers. You should be able to find this book online and hopefully in good bookstores everywhere. Gore Vidal, why do you think John Kerry and the Democrats have not raised more hell about this if they had the election stolen, since, you know, they spent zillions of dollars to try to get elected?
Well, that is a great question. There are those cynics, and I am not that cynical, but who maintain that what is called the Democratic Party is just a shadow of the Republican Party, and that those who live within the Beltway are happy within the Beltway. And most of them are lobbyists for great corporations, and they serve in Congress, not their states, not their constituencies, but they serve the great interest. And they are happy with it, and so who is president doesn't seem all that important. Things started to change, as we remember, before the 2004 election, when suddenly there is one trait in the American people that is constant. We don't like foreign wars. We have to be dragged screaming into these things, which we are done by propaganda, by total obfuscation, the telling of big, big lies about the weapons of mass destruction, and that Iran gets nuclear weapons, they'll just use them against us because they're evil and we're good. Now, if you can get a majority of the people to believe junk like that, yes, I mean, there is no doubt that they will get nuclear weapons. If there's something called a deterrent, and they want to deter us from unilaterally attacking them, as we attacked Afghanistan, as we attacked Iraq, two countries that had done us no harm and had no power to do us any harm. But they had oil, and we are governed by an oil, natural gas junta. And the junta wants the second largest oil reserves in the world, which are in Iraq, and they also got their eye on Central Asia, the Caspian Sea area, and that is huge oil reserves. That's what we're up to. And the American people are just being used. They're lied to. They have a media that is so corrupt now and so expert at changing the subject. This last election seemed to me to be not about the Iraq war, which was getting very low marks with the public. They don't like it. Nor do they care about, they don't like Bush's handling of it. But instead, I believe the election was about gay marriage, a subject of no great interest to George Washington and should not be of any great interest to George W. Bush. It's known as, you know, carefully changing the subject, and when all the media follows the same line, since much of it is owned by the same people, the same corporations, we are tightly censored. Yes, a program like this can exist, but, you know, you need dialogue, and you need argument among people and stations and programs and newspapers. That was the dream of Thomas Jefferson, who once said, between, you know, having politics and elections and newspapers, I pick newspapers. Well, those of us who know and love the Champaign-Urbana Gazette, and I am one, will say that would be nice for Illinois if that was all they had and they could get rid of the politics, but unfortunately it's going to be the other way around.
We're talking to Gore Vidal today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Gore Vidal needs no introduction to our listeners, a novelist, playwright, and essayist, probably one of the leading critics and commentators on American politics and life over the past five decades. It's an honor to have you on the air with us today, Mr. Vidal. This is a pre-recorded show, so please do not try to call in. We taped it about a week and a half before the airing, so sit back, relax, and allow us to do the talking. Gore Vidal, you know, you mentioned the Democrats really haven't put up much of a struggle, apparently, against the Republicans. Do you think this is a temporary malady? Do you think they can locate more of an opposition sense, or do you think this is a fundamental problem we face?
I think it's a fundamental problem because partly due to a dire educational system, which refuses to teach American history properly, or doesn't know how. It doesn't make any difference, the motives. It just doesn't. And I spent, you know, 30 years of my life doing that series of novels, Burr and Lincoln and 1876, turning myself into a history teacher, which I certainly didn't want to be. But I was so in such despair because I was in active politics in the 60s. And how little information was getting through to the people about what kind of country we have and what is our history and where are we going. So I wrote those books. Then I've become politically active on television, as you pointed out, and radio and so on. There isn't much dialogue, and there is not much information. And when you have a president and a vice president who every 5 minutes are saying, it's not if they're going to attack us, it's when. Red alert. Well, you heard all those red alerts that we got during the late election of 2004, and every other day there was an alert from some terrible danger to us from Saddam Hussein, who was working with Osama bin Laden. They hate each other, but of course for the purposes of propaganda they were. So you kept being told about in what danger we were from these people. The election is over. And there hasn't been one alert since that I'm aware of. Now, what does that mean? Could they have been using the alerts to frighten us into returning a government which had started two wars and seems to be losing both of them in Iraq and Afghanistan? At least put it this way, we have not won the peace there that we boasted of. Well, it is a policy. It is known to dictatorships all over the world from the beginning of time. You frighten the people. You frighten them with some great monolithic enemy. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, remember the Cold War, if only dimly. We were out there to stop the rise of communism wherever it was in the world. Well, it wasn't much of anywhere outside of the Soviet Union. For a time, it seemed to be China, but China turns everything into something Chinese, like the Manchu dynasty. So they ended up not monolithic. But we fought the war in Iran and Indochina in order to contain China, which was supposedly on the march. I used to go on television with Lyndon Johnson's spokesman, and they'd always I'd say, why are we in Indochina? It's not been explained to the people. What are we doing fighting there? Oh, we're there to contain China. I said, well, then we should be fighting for Ho Chi Minh and the Indochinese. Oh, no, no, you can't do that. I said, well, if you want to contain China, for 1,000 years, the greatest enemies that China has on earth are the people of Indochina. So we're fighting the people who could contain China for us. They changed the subject then.
We're talking to Gore Vidal today in Media Matters. Again, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Among other things we're talking about are the new book, What Went Wrong in Ohio, the Conyers Report on the 2004 Presidential Election, which features an introduction by Gore Vidal. It was edited by Anita Miller and published by up in Chicago by the Academy Chicago Publishers. I urge people to pick it up. It's a short compendium put together, which really details and chronicles what was found by a comprehensive analysis of the voting problems in Ohio and has a series of recommendations in the end of the book. You know, I am 52 years old, and it was only in 2000, really, that the idea of stolen elections became commonplace in our political discussion. I think, you know, in the 70s or 80s, the idea that people were swiping elections, I mean, you heard about Lyndon Johnson doing it or the Chicago machine, but in general, there was sort of a working assumption that the elections could be counted on to be reliable. Apparently, that assumption is no longer justifiable, given the evidence. And in fact, Mr. Vidal, in the introduction, you call this a valuable guide to how to steal an election. How do you steal an election nowadays?
Well, you have to plan 4 years ahead. I'm sorry, I make this sound like a cooking class. But at the same time, you take 1 pound of butter. Or grease.
And, yeah, lots of grease.
And spread it around. Well, the first thing you do, you figure out which are the essential states. Ohio, the old Western Reserve, which includes parts of Illinois. You know, New Englanders who moved west. Ohio is all important. It's basically a kind of with a large blue-collar working class. A Rust Belt state, but very, very important. Great deal of population, great deal of political savvy. It was known as the mother of presidents. Four or five of the United States presidents have come out of Ohio. So that was targeted early. Now, here's how you go about stealing it. In most of the states of the Union, if not all, the Secretary of State of the state is in charge of the electoral machinery. So the first person they get their hands on, they being the oil and gas junta that's in charge of our government, they get a hold of Mr. Kenneth Blackwell, who is the Secretary of State of Ohio. You can read all this in the book, but he is key, and he is in charge of elections. And he decides who admitted. I mean, to whom you send out requests for voting. He decides what machines. A key player, many of us have been warning for about 4 years now against electronic voting machines that have, as they say, no paper trail. There's no way of checking on whether it was hacked and whether the vote was proper or not. And the companies, starting with Diebold and going on to Triad, there are about five or six of them, they're very expensive too. They provide these electronic machines. You press what you think you're going to vote for, Kerry, or you're going to vote for Bush. Others know how, particularly if the Secretary of State is in charge of people who are watching the polling booths, counting. You can corrupt the entire system, and the details of this corruption, which I will not go into now and spoil the suspense of those who want to read this hair-raising little book.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is hair-raising.
Yes, it is hair-raising. And it's so cold-blooded. Mr. Blackwell, about whom I know nothing except I have his name here in the book, when Congressman Conyers and the other congressmen came out to Ohio to investigate what went wrong, the Secretary of State, who's in charge of the whole thing, Mr. Blackwell, refused to answer any questions. He didn't have to. He was too important. And he didn't want them sniffing around. So he admits guilt, or at least some kind of complicity, by not answering any of the questions of Congressman Conyers, who is a most responsible man and not a muckraker, but somebody very concerned over the republic. That do we have one left? I mean, one of the companies, there's Diebold, Sequoia, S&S, Triad. Now, part of the report says this last voting company, computer company, and they sell these machines at great cost all around the country. I think almost every state has quite a few electronic machines, and something always funny goes wrong with them. People know how to hack them. And Triad admitted to the Congressional Committee that during the recount in numerous counties, they had provided, these are the people in charge of the voting, what they call cheat sheets. And the cheat sheets informed election officials, and these are people who were supposed to be surveying the election at the balloting places, in order to ensure that you get an honest result. The cheat sheets informed election officials how many votes they should find for each candidate and how many over and under votes they should calculate to match the machine's counts. In other words, that's so you don't suddenly have a million votes for the vegetarian candidate when indeed you're trying to get those votes over to Mr. Bush. The results were sometimes just surrealistic. I mean, there were three, in one county, there were three third-party candidates that no one had ever heard of with no money at all. And suddenly, they got huge slices of votes. Whereas Kerry, the first Democratic candidate for president in many years, who was well-financed, got fewer than these three.
Mm-hmm. This is in a whole county?
Yes. I mean, and it was a mystery. I mean, you know, it was like the Grail. How on earth could this happen? It was magical. Well, this went on. I mean, there was one example which really struck me, that they discovered that at one polling place at one time, they had a record that 6,000 people had stood in line. There's a lot of standing in line if they don't want you to vote. Had stood in line, but had finally, they lasted long enough to cast their votes. Yet, all 6,000 of them had been standing in line all day to cast their vote. All 6,000 did not vote for president. They were too busy voting for assemblyman. or whatever minor sheriff, whatever minor offices were on the menu. That's called undervoting, and I call that corruption. Somebody got to them. Somebody just shifted those votes.
How many undervotes were there in the Ohio presidential race?
I have it here in the book, but I'm not at the right page.
So. I think it was 93,000, if I'm not mistaken.
I suspect it was probably more because there were a lot of things that were moot. I mean,
yeah, there were so many different things. There were 93,000, I'm sorry, you're right, spoiled ballots where there was no vote recorded for president, which is a different phenomenon.
Yeah, or sometimes called undervoting, that they didn't vote.
Yeah.
And yet we know that they were voting.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow or other, the presidency didn't catch their eye. But,
you know, when you talked about these long lines for voting, my impression was, and I don't know how much the book goes into this, that if you were in a heavily Republican district, there weren't very long lines at all. But if you were in a predominantly Democratic district, that's where you found these, you know, around-the-block lines.
Oh, yes. And particularly in Florida. Florida was famous for it because of the heat down there. And there were all these nice, old, retired people from New York City who vote Democratic, who were out there in the sun all day, fainting away, and sometimes unable to get around to voting. Well, that was a deliberate tactic. And everything in politics, like everything in television, is unoriginal, is repetitive. If you remember back in 2000, it was the same situation as it was in 2004 in Ohio. In 2000, the Secretary of State of Florida was Catherine Harris. Remember her with
Certainly.
All the mascara and the long eyelashes? Magnificent creature. And this magnificent creature was also the Florida chair. Chairwoman, chairperson for Bush Cheney. Well, comes Ohio, 4 years later, Bush Cheney are up again, and Bush Cheney don't have many fans out there. They're, in a normal election, they would lose the popular vote and probably electoral college vote. So what do they do? 4 years, they have 4 years in which to see to it. They have the same situation in Ohio that they had in Florida. So in Ohio, they get hold of Kenneth Blackwell, who's also the chairman of the Republican campaign for Bush Cheney. Duplicate of what happened in Florida. You can, one of the ways you can trap criminals in the United States is the total unoriginality. I mean, for the last 40 or 50 years, it's always been the Lee Harvey Oswald. If anybody gets assassinated, lone crazed killer, lone crazed killer, communist, lone crazed killer. They've almost, these murders have almost always been plots, but oh no, you're not a conspiracy theory. Oh no, you must believe in flying saucers. Well, everything in the United States is a conspiracy. Haven't we figured that out yet? Whether it's the tobacco companies saying smoke Lucky Strikes because then you'll be healthy. I mean, everyone conspires to cheat the people and conspires to seize power. What is a political party but a conspiracy to seize the power of the state? Any child can work that one out, but I guess the children are not in charge yet.
We're talking to Gore Vidal today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Gore Vidal has written the introduction for a new book, What Went Wrong in Ohio, The Conyers Report on the 2004 Presidential Election, just published by Academy Chicago Publishers out of Chicago. We've been talking about the 2004 election for the past half hour or so here on Media Matters. This is a recorded show, as I said, so please don't try to call in. Gore Vidal needs no introduction, I think, to almost all of our listeners. He is one of the great novelists, playwrights, and essayists in 20th century and now 21st century American life. And your work on history, Mr. Vidal, that you referred to earlier, Burr, Lincoln, 1876, was very influential for many people in my generation coming of age in the 70s. And what would you say to young people today, the biggest misconceptions that are generally held about the history of the country they live in? What do they not know about it that they ought to know?
Well, they ought to know something a little grim. It's that the founding fathers are not good Christian men. Hardly any women among them, but good Christian men. Well, they weren't good Christians. Most of them called themselves deists, which meant they believed in the idea of God, but were pretty vague about what it was. In other words, they were not religious. So this religious right that we see all over the place, rattling the bars of its cage and shrieking, Jesus wants me for a sunbeam, these would be anathema to people like Thomas Jefferson or James Madison. They were deists. They were not religious men. Jefferson went so far as to write his own Bible, in which he took the ethical teachings of Jesus, whom he much admired but did not worship, and made a new Bible in which he leaves out all the miracles. And it's a very nice little job he did. However, it's been considerably suppressed. So you start out, our founders did not put under God all over the money and all over the buildings. There was none of that because we weren't under God. We were under really the symbols of a republic based more or less on the Roman model. The founders feared two things that they feared the United States might become. One was tyranny, a monarchy, a dictator, a single ruler. That's what they thought King George III was, and they didn't want anything like it happening over here. So they wanted a republic. The other thing that they feared and detested, and it's all through their writings in the Federalist Papers, was democracy. They didn't like it, in which practically every working Republican today is on the side of the founders, I'm sorry to say, because they don't like democracy either, even in the limited forms that we have ever had it. And we don't have much of it. We've had problems with fixed elections since the beginning of the country. That does not make it a good thing.
So how is this anti-democratic bias reflected in the Constitution?
The Electoral College was designed to make sure that the people not govern. And it is a device by which it was originally created to save the small states from the big states. So in the recent discussions about the judges and during the Senate, more than one senator was bright enough to say, well, this is supposed we're thwarting majority rules, said one of the Democrats. But we are the majority. We may be a minority of the members of the Senate, but the states that we represent are California, are Illinois, are New York. They represent Wyoming and Mississippi, states with very small population. So everything is vice versa. To protect the small states, the Electoral College was created, and it automatically each state has two members, one for each of the two senators, and then they get one or two, whatever it is, for their members of the House of Representatives.
One.
And there they are. And it means a group of states with small population can turn around and reverse the popular election in which, well, we saw in 2000, Gore ran a couple of million votes ahead of Bush in the popular election nationally. But in the Electoral College, due to the shenanigans in Florida, he had lost the Electoral College vote.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a device to keep us from becoming a democracy. And we never have been one. I remember also, and this is for vote getting, I used to live in Dutchess County, upstate New York. And in the last years of her life, I was a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt, who was a very canny old bird. And she said, she was talking about the first election she was involved in was 1910. when her husband Franklin was running for the state senate, first Democrat to win in a long time. He won because they thought he was Theodore Roosevelt. But she said I was so innocent. She said I rushed home one day after canvassing in Dutchess County, and I said, Franklin, do you realize that people are buying votes here in Dutchess County? And he said, don't worry, dear. The Republicans are buying them, too. I should point out the Roosevelts were Democrats.
For those who don't know.
For those who don't know, yeah. So that's always been a small problem. It is now a major problem and is now decisive. It wouldn't be so bad if it was just who was going to get what office in order to steal money. I mean, we're used to theft. But while we're talking about empire, we're talking about war and peace, we're talking about American soldiers, some professional, some reservists, being shot every day in a war that has not been explained to any of us, a war that was not declared by Congress as the Constitution requires. It is totally outside the Constitution. It's a unilateral executive war. The president seems to think that anybody he calls a terrorist is a terrorist, and we can blow him up if we can find where he lives. And the war on terror is an advertising slogan. Terror is an abstract noun. You can't have a war in an abstract noun. You need a country. So they figured that one out, so they decided, well, all the terrorists lived in Afghanistan and in Iraq. The game is so dumb, and if we had a proper media, it would be explained to them. Everybody in Europe knows what's going on. That's why we keep trashing the Europeans, because their press is honest on these matters anyway. And no word. I've spent most of my life reading the American press. I have never read a story favorable to another country, because other countries have better health care, better education, better this, better that, more honest elections. And so we have to trash them. We say the Swedes, oh yeah, they have wonderful health care for everybody, daycare centers for working mothers, educate, all this. They have all this, but they're alcoholics and they commit suicide. Which means that if you have a good education, good health care, good wages, you're so bored, you got to kill yourself, or take to drink, or both.
Yeah, let me go back, if I can, for a second, Corvidal, to your comments about the Founding Fathers and religion. Since religion is such a huge part of our political culture in the United States today, you wrote a book about Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln famously, early in his career, in effect, announced he was an atheist, and has been resuscitated now by the religious right as sort of a born-again Christian by the time he hit the White House. Is that an accurate reading on Abraham Lincoln?
Well, pretty much. He was... Lincoln wrote a book, a pamphlet, when he was a young man, but he's already practicing law and getting ready to go into the Illinois legislature. And according to his law partner, Herndon, he wrote a... a treatise called Infidelity, which had nothing to do with marriage. It had to do with infidelity means lack of faith or unfaithful, meaning that he was against religion, particularly Christianity. And Herndon read it with great admiration and then put it in the fire because he knew Lincoln was going to have a great political career and this was not going to help him. The only point that the evangelicals might have in this is that he never said a word about Jesus Christ in his entire career that I could find. However, as the Civil War got more and more bloody and he began to feel more and more guilty because he had a lot to do with getting it going, he begins to use, and you see it in his speeches, the Almighty, as in the Almighty knows and we do not what is to come next. And so he is getting some sort of strange religious transcendental sense of the nation, of the Union, and of his own role. And I conclude at the end of my book, Lincoln, that after the assassination, I put it into Mary Todd, his now widow, that she felt that he had willed his own murder to atone for what, as Lincoln called it, what an astounding and fundamental reshaping he had given to his nation. And
do you think he regrets the war? Do you think he wishes that he just let the South secede?
No, he never got that far. He had made a whole mystical religion out of the sacredness of the Union. Nobody else felt like that. Seward, his Secretary of State, who was in many ways a much better politician than Lincoln, Seward was very airy about it. He said, let this, what he called the Mosquito Republics. Let the Mosquito Republics go. They're not going to go anywhere. They'll have to come back to us in time because there's no place for them. They're not going to join Mexico. And meanwhile, said Seward cheerily, let's take the Caribbean, let's take Canada, and we might have a go at Venezuela. That was really imperialism at work. Lincoln pointed out, since we can't seem to take New York back, I don't know how on earth we're going to take Mexico. Lincoln was immensely practical. But, no, he had a... Well, he put everything down on his oath, the war. And at the first inaugural, he said, the choice of war or peace, my countrymen, is yours, not mine. He's speaking to the South. And he said, for my part, I am for peace, I am for reason in all of this. But he said, at one level, he said, of the preservation of the Union, he said, I have no choice. I have sworn an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. I can do no other. And upon that rather slender piece of logic, the war was fought.
Do you think, had Lincoln not been assassinated and been able to complete his second term, do you think the course of Reconstruction and subsequent U.S. history might have been different, or would it not have made much of a difference?
I think he probably would have made a great deal of difference. One of his last orders to General Grant, when they were down at Richmond, the fallen southern capital, Grant, the only real chat they had about the post-war period, because of almost immediately afterwards Lincoln was shot. But Grant said, you know, he was doing mopping up down there, and he said, how do we act? How do we treat them? And Lincoln said, let them up easy, let them up easy. I think he would have let them up easy.
We're talking to Gore Vidal today, Media Matters. We've only got a few minutes left. Again, this is a recorded show. Please don't try to call in. Gore Vidal is the author of numerous wonderful novels, plays, and essays on politics and many other things, and also has written the introduction to a brand new book, What Went Wrong in Ohio, The Conyers Report on the 2004 Presidential Election, edited by Anita Miller, published up in nearby Chicago by the Academy Chicago Publishers, a book with a detailed outline of the problems in Ohio with the 2004 election and a series of recommendations. It is chilling reading, and I think chilling reading even for those who are not prone to think in terms of as cynically as others might about how power is exercised in our society. The back of the book features strong recommendations from people like Bob Kerry, the former Nebraska senator, now president of New School University. And I think it's a book that is well worth everyone taking a very close look at. We've only got a few minutes left, Mr. Vidal, and I want to talk a little bit, if I can, about an issue you've thought about and written about to some extent, and we've broached it briefly before, which is the two-party system. It's not in our Constitution, but it has emerged, and we've talked about the Democrats' sort of lack of opposition to what's going on. Is it the two-party system basically incompatible with having effective republic, or is it the nature of the two parties we've got, or do we need a third party or a new second party? What is your take on the party system and where it's at in the United States today?
Well, the founders, when they were inventing the Constitution, they were very, very seriously against political parties because they'd seen what a mess they'd made of England. And they referred to them not as parties, but as faction. And they did not like factions, which were usually groups of ambitious men trying to seize the power and the glory, not to mention the money, of the state for themselves. So they didn't like it, but they automatically split up into two, largely regional. There was the Southern Bloc, dominated by Virginia, the Northern Bloc, dominated by Massachusetts, and then Pennsylvania and New York. So there were a lot of local interests. You cannot have, one of our problems has been, is we like to think of ourselves as a classless society. Well, we have all sorts of different classes, and they sort of go by the regions. And you cannot have, it was Tony Blair of all people, who, when he invented New Labour for England and got rid of the old Labour Party, Blair was accused of having got politics out of politics, and Blair said, no, I was the first politician who realized, this is back in 1997, that politics had gone out of politics, because you cannot have a political party that is not based upon class interests. Now, we are never as highly stratified in the matter of class as the Brits are. They're obsessed with it. But we have the farmers, that's a class. We have manufacturing workers, that's a class. We have regional classes, as we had the slaveholding South at the beginning of the country. There are a lot of interests out there that get represented politically. I would say that if there is to be a political realignment, which I think could happen, and Howard Dean may be very essential in this, or at least the earlier Howard Dean, there's going to be a split in the country, and it's going to be a huge one. After the disappointment of what is going wrong in the Middle East, between the imperialists and the anti-imperialists, the imperialists are going to say, we must seize all the oil in the world before anybody else gets it. That's when they turn honest. It isn't bringing liberty and democracy, something we never tried, to the Iraqis. We don't care about them. We care about their oil. But we have to put some kind of face on it. It's going to be between those who think we ought to have this huge nuclear military capacity in order to threaten countries, in order to steal their oil, or get it cheap, or keep it away from our competitors commercially. Well, that's a real interest, grabbing that oil. And for those of us, I think, who are somewhat wiser, if you do that, there's no action in physics without reaction. If you take people's oil away, you're going to get a kamikaze bomber in your backyard. They'll pay you back. They'll pay you back fast with modern technology. So in that direction, there is war, imperial war, and we're too small a country. We have this notion that we're the largest country, the richest country, this or that. Well, we're not. We're a kind of middling country. And if we keep on losing these wars and losing our dollar and losing the economy, we're going to end up where we belong, somewhere between Argentina and Brazil.
Gore Vidal, I, to my considerable regret, hear the band tuning up in the background, which means our time has expired.
I thought that was mariachi music.
Thelonious Monk, very close. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters. My name is Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today.
We're beginning to pull together the new budget for WILL Radio. The program schedule we can provide on this station depends on meeting our fundraising goal by June 30th. You can still help. If it's time for you to renew your membership, please call 217-244-9455 with a contribution. Thank you.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, becoming mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high in the upper 70s with southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The low in the mid-50s with north winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high in the lower 70s with northeast winds around 10 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, public radio for Central Illinois. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.